Our next case this morning is case number 10-1364, James Hernandez versus Foster. Mr. Bess.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Mike Bess, representing the Hernandez family. This appeal raises important issues regarding the state's power to seize a toddler from his parents despite having firsthand evidence that the toddler's injury was not the product of abuse. When 15-month-old James Hernandez fell out of his crib, his parents took him to the hospital. The treating doctor initially suspected possible abuse due to confusion about whether James could walk or climb. If he could not walk or climb, how could he have fallen out of his crib? Acting on this suspicion, a state investigator went to the Hernandez's home and saw for herself that James could indeed walk and climb, negating the initial concern. And she even reported to her supervisor that everything looked fine. There's nothing that seemed suspicious or anything like that. And that
didn't she get some information that was inconsistent about who was in the home when the incident occurred?
That information was actually already in their possession. That came from the initial hotline report from the nurse. And both, there's no dispute that the state agreed that they had no probable cause prior to the home investigation. So this wasn't a new fact that she learned upon the home investigation. They already had that. And everyone agrees that there was no probable cause at that point. That inconsistency was noted in the nurse's report, but not in the home investigation. So, again, she reported that she did not see any reason to go any further, but the state forcibly removed James anyway and then kept him in protective custody and away from his home for 10 days without a hearing. The evidence, when viewed as it must be in Hernandez's favor, demonstrates that these actions violated their clearly established constitutional rights. First, it was both clearly established and a matter of common sense that the state cannot forcibly remove a toddler from his home without probable cause of abuse. And here, the initial suspicion, which everyone agrees did not supply probable cause, was discredited by actual observation. Second, it was both clearly established and a matter of common sense that the state cannot keep the child from his home when probable cause, even if it ever existed, has evaporated. And here, they kept the toddler despite additional medical evidence confirming that no abuse occurred, and despite the fact that the assistant state's attorney refused to file a petition for temporary state custody for lack of evidence. And finally, it was both clearly established and a matter of common sense that the state cannot coerce a safety plan on the parents by telling them that they could not even see their son unless they agreed to it, and by informing them that they had no parental rights.
Do we know why? Does the record tell us why the regional manager of the Department of Child and Family Services directed that the child be removed from the home when the two caseworkers reported that everything checked out?
Well, the regional manager, Mr. Rupi, did not recall a specific conversation over the basis for ordering the removal. There was some discrepancy in the record regarding what was communicated by the first supervisor to the larger supervisor, Rupi. So there's basically a discrepancy in the testimony in terms of what was communicated.
So we don't know what his information base is?
We do not know the information basis. That's correct.
But Foster, the
investigator,
agent,
yes,
investigator, was only directed to do that, right? As I understand it, her judgment was that the child didn't need to be removed at that point.
Well, she testified in her deposition. She did not say ultimately that. She said she couldn't recall either way what her judgment or whether she had any judgment. She did testify that she communicated the fact that the child could walk and climb to Foster Smith, who was immediate supervisor. Okay, so there's clear testimony that that was communicated to Foster Smith, and Foster Smith herself, the supervisor, admitted to that, acknowledged that she was told that. So there was clear evidence that that was instructed and told to Foster Smith. The question is, the record is unclear what was communicated to Rupi.
Is it your position that if we find disputed issues of material fact, here relevant to qualified immunity or the merits, that, that the case should go back for to pursue claims against all three of the individual defendants and, in essence, let them sort out the questions of individual responsibility?
Correct. There was a little bit of pass the buck here between the defendants. The investigator was arguing, well, I was only kind of following orders and doing what I was told, and the supervisors were saying, well, we weren't there. So that would be our position, that certainly at trial, these factual inconsistencies can be resolved. In any event, it was premature to resolve these issues as a matter of summary judgment, particularly in favor of defendants. I want to sort of isolate the three claims, if I can, for a second. First, starting with the seizure. Again, the test is reasonableness and probable cause. A good reason to act is how Judge Easterbrook has described it. And here, all agree that there was no probable cause before the in-home visit. Foster Smith, the state has never argued otherwise. So then we focus on the actual investigation. Focus on Foster's direct observations. She saw a normal child interacting, walking, climbing, a stable home, and then she communicated that to her supervisor. Again, everything looked fine. There's nothing that seemed suspicious or anything like that, and that she did not see any reason to go any further. Now, the district court concluded that this right was not clearly established, but that simply isn't true. Bevier, Brokaw, Heck, Gressbach, established that a state cannot remove a toddler without a warrant, consent, probable cause, or exigent circumstances. Here the issue was probable cause. Those cases also established that the state can't take a mere allegation or suspicion of abuse and not do any follow-up investigation. Okay. Here the state did that investigation, but then actually turned a blind eye to the actual facts that were revealed. And Bevier actually instructs that an officer in the context of a seizure may not close their eyes to facts that would help clarify circumstances of an arrest. So here, there was no problem with the doctor having an initial concern based on inconsistencies on what could have happened with the crib. But those questions were answered.
There was bruising also in the face somewhere.
There was bruising behind the left eye, which the mother testified was an old injury based on playing with a toy. That, again, was initially reported on the hotline call. So when the investigator went to the home, she did observe the bruise, but there were no other additional facts that were uncovered that indicated that that played into any kind of abuse. So in other words, that was an old fact. And the new investigation, the investigation in-home, shed no new light on that. So it's not as if that was a new evidence that was uncovered during the investigation. Okay. So, again, they acknowledge they had no probable cause. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The appropriate inquiry here is, you know, the on-the-scene investigators had a certain body of information from the hospital, right? And that includes that we've got a 15-month-old baby.
Yep.
Fell out of his crib. He's got this injury.
Yes.
And that the doctors were concerned that it was an abuse-related injury.
Correct.
And that he had this unrelated bruising that was unexplained. There was the inconsistent explanation about whether the child could walk or climb.
Okay.
And then the inconsistent information about who was at home. And the relevant piece of that was dispelled by the home visit had to do with the baby's ability to walk or climb.
That's correct.
Of the baseline information was still there at that moment. It was later dispelled as we get sort of down the road in the chronology.
That's actually not true. One aspect of what you said, that there was no explanation, that's actually not true. The parents said from the get-go that the baby fell out of the crib. Okay, they went downstairs. The baby was on the floor right next to the crib crying and had a fractured wrist, essentially, which was later confirmed with a buckle fracture.
I guess I'm remembering it that they said they didn't know what happened, but they thought.
That's correct.
Right.
They testified that they didn't observe directly what happened, but they surmised that he fell out of the crib, and that was communicated to the supervisor. To DCFS. Also importantly, this confusion continued after the home investigation. Okay, when Foster Stith, testified that there was confusion There was still no explanation for the injury. Well, that's completely negated by the investigation because the parents again reiterated that the baby did fall out of the crib, and then we had the additional information of seeing firsthand that the baby could fall out.
I have trouble with that.
Sure.
Was that it was completely negated.
Sure.
There were some explanations that might have worked, but I'm not sure they yet knew how it happened. There is the break, the fracture.
Right.
Possible explanation, but I don't think all possible explanations.
Not all possible explanations. I agree with that. But also consider that the supervisor, Foster Smith, called back the hospital prior to going into the home and confirmed that it was a buccal fracture, which is basically a direct hit to the arm, not a twisting, not the type of fracture that is typical in abuse cases. So that's an additional fact that they had that was not.
Well, is it clear that they understood the import of the identification of the specific type of fracture? I thought that didn't come until later. They were told it was a buccal fracture, but you know, who knows whether they understood what that...
It was important enough that Foster Stiff called before sending the investigator to find out what type of fracture it was. So if she didn't understand the significance of it, why did she call in the first place?
Right, but I thought it wasn't until the later medical reports, some 24 hours later, that...
That's not true. There were additional medical tests that were, there was a radiological, there was a skeletal survey, which confirmed that also. But no, they were armed with the fact that it was a buccal fracture before the investigation, before the actual investigator was...
But my question,
sure.
Were they armed with the information about the significance of a buccal fracture to a child abuse investigation?
The record is unclear on that point. I would argue that you can infer from the circumstances. Why else would they ask? And let's also keep in mind that this is their job to investigate child abuse, and they don't know what type of fracture and the significance of that. I guess I would argue that it was pretty clear through the circumstances that they should have been aware, at least. So
this, would you agree that the constitutional standard does not allow removal of a child because of the possibility that
correct.
An injury might have been an abuse injury?
That's absolutely correct.
And here you've got, after the home visit with the firsthand observation that James
correct.
Could walk and climb, you've got a pretty obvious, a pretty likely explanation, even if you don't have a videotape of the fall.
That's correct. I completely agree, Your Honor. If I can just...
I need to move you
please,
forward just
please.
A little bit to the safety plan.
Please, yes.
What do you have in the record about what Foster Stiff and Rupi knew that Foster would tell tell the parents when the compelled safety plan...
Foster Stiff and Rupi gave a general okay to the safety plan. In terms of what Foster Stiff, I believe, testified that she gave general instructions on what a safety plan is.
Right, but about compelling the signing of the safety plan.
There is no evidence that the supervisors instructed the investigator that they could compel the safety plan.
So how can they be liable?
Because they directed the safety plan.
But they didn't direct her to lie about whether they get to see their child or what have you when she was trying to get the signatures.
Well, they can still be responsible for example, in the substantive due process context, the fact that this was done without probable cause. Right.
Well, but if you've got a voluntary agreement, a truly voluntary agreement to a
right.
safety plan, how do you have a substantive due process violation?
Very briefly, by the way, and this is under Dupuy. There's a clearly established violation of Dupuy here. This case is distinguishable from that case. I will ask the court please to look at Appendix 673 and Appendix 674, which is the safety plan. Unlike Dupuy, here the child had already been taken from the home, okay? And the typical safety plan, it's an interim agreement reached to find out more information and then make it in lieu of just taking the child from the home. Here, if you actually read the language of the safety plan, it actually says, safety plans are to be developed only where a decision of unsafe has been made, and workers with supervisory approval assess that without the plan, the children must be removed from the home. It also says on the next page, 674, do not complete this page if protective custody is taken. So they used a boilerplate safety plan, not applicable in this situation, And then they rely on other boilerplate language that says it's voluntary.
Having been told that the state's attorney isn't going to seek a protective order.
Correct. Armed with that knowledge.
That was the day before. Right?
That's absolutely correct. Your Honor, unless you have any more questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Welsh.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Mary Welsh. I'm here on behalf of the defendants, appellees. There are two questions here. One is, did the plaintiffs provide sufficient evidence for a jury to find in their favor on any of their claims against any of the defendants, and if they also showed that there were clearly established violations of constitutional law here? The answer to both questions is no, and that's why this Court should affirm the judgment. With regard to the seizure in particular, plaintiff is incorrect to say that we agreed, the state agreed that there was no probable cause when we went to the house. That's not true. What is true is that two of the defendants didn't believe there was probable cause. But probable cause is an objective standard, so what any individual thinks doesn't matter. It's whether probable cause exists, if there's a good reason to act, given, as the plaintiffs agree, given what is known to each individual person. So, for example, Mr. Rupi knew only what he was told by Foster Stith, and he doesn't recall certain things, but his lack of recollection doesn't create a question of fact. It creates no question of fact.
So is it your position then that the hotline report was enough to justify removal without a hearing?
No, not a hotline report alone, because you don't know who called. Anybody can call up and say, I'm a doctor and I saw this. But what we had here, by the time that Ms. Foster went to the home, what we know is that two medical professionals suspect abuse. And why do they suspect abuse? Because there's an unexplained second bruise. You have a nonverbal child, small child, can't tell what happened, who has a serious injury. You have parents who can't get it straight about who was home at the time. They don't know what happened. They think, they surmise that the child fell out of the crib. That's what they say, of course, but they're not going to say, I threw the child on the floor. I cracked the kid's arm. I mean, parents aren't going to say that. So you have to know, so these are the facts that are known when Foster gets to the house.
And do you think that's enough to remove the child without just summarily without a hearing or anything else?
Well, because she didn't walk in and remove the child.
We're trying to take this step by step.
Right.
I thought that you wanted to dispute what the plaintiff's counsel was saying about whether there was probable cause before the home visit.
I think it's a close question about whether before the visit there was probable cause. I think that's a close question. But what we know when she did come to the house was that there were, now we know, in the hospital, the plaintiffs told the medical professionals the child cannot climb. This was not something that the medical professionals thought on themselves. They told them this again and again. And in fact, when the plaintiffs were told that DCFS had been called, the plaintiffs said, oh, he can walk, he can't climb. So there's no misunderstanding here. The plaintiffs, and this is on page 706 of the supplemental appendix, the plaintiffs said he cannot climb. Now, why did they say this? I don't know. Maybe they thought they were going to get in trouble because, as it turns out later, the mattress was too high, there was stuff in the crib, which they also said was not there. So here, Foster gets to the house, the kid can climb. Why did they lie? This is the kind of thing, why would parents lie about a child's ability to climb? That doesn't negate probable cause. That raises all kinds of questions.
Well, let me ask you about that. As you saw in the reply brief from the plaintiffs, they say, wait a minute, where does this idea that this was a lie come from, at least as an undisputed fact for purposes of summary judgment?
They have never said, we didn't tell the medical professionals he couldn't climb. They have never said that. There is no dispute about what they told the medical professionals.
Okay, but you're calling it a lie.
It's not true.
Okay, well, sometimes people are wrong, and I don't know about you, but a lot of parents sometimes find out that their kids can do something for the first time. There's always a first time, and you need to take precautions suddenly, right?
That may well be, but they also never said that. I mean, if they had suggested any of these things, perhaps that would diminish probable cause, but they never said these things. So the only facts we know are they told the medical professionals he can't climb, and they said it again and again. So they get to the house. The foster gets to the house. She says she sees he can climb. So that raises more red flags. Why are the parents lying? Ms. Hernandez says, oh, I lowered the mattress. Well, that means that, you know, probably it was too high. She also sees there's stuff in the crib, but the plaintiffs had said, oh, no, there was nothing in the crib.
But her judgment that she reported back to her superiors was that everything's fine there. I see no reason to go further.
With all due respect to Ms. Foster, she's the line person. She doesn't have that much experience. She'd only been there for a year or two.
The fact is, there is at least a disputed fact that was her assessment at that point in time.
Right, and I don't know how much she knew about what as much as Foster Stith knew, because Foster Stith was the only person who had spoken to the medical professionals. So we don't know. I mean, and again, you know, Foster...
And all Foster Stith knows is that it's a buckle fracture.
Well, she knows that there's the second bruise. She knows that the plaintiff's stories were inconsistent about who was home. The parents don't know how the second bruise happened. She knows that the plaintiff said that the child can't climb, and suddenly he can climb. She knows all of these things, more things than Foster knows. And so she made the decision with Rupi. And again, Rupi's inability to remember a conversation does not create a question of fact. Rupi knew only what he was told, and the only evidence we have of what he was told is from Foster Stith. So there is, excuse me. So Mr. Rupi knows only what he's been told. Again, there's a very young child, nonverbal, has a serious injury, has another unexplained second injury. The parents don't know. They surmise, but they don't know how he got the broken arm. And they were inconsistent in talking to the medical professionals, the people that we think people are always honest with, about who was home at the time, perhaps because they wanted to shield somebody from possible suspicion. We don't know. But all of this creates this good reason to act, and that's all you need to take the child into protective custody.
Well, even assuming that that's the case, that there's good reason to act to remove the child from the home, or at least that it was not clearly established that removal would violate the parent's constitutional rights or the child's, the continued removal of the child from the parent's custody by virtue of this safety plan that they were confronted with as the clock was ticking on the 48 hours to the hearing, and the caseworkers had already been told that the state's attorney was not going to seek a judicial order keeping the child from them, and so there was no legal basis to continue to hold the child.
Well, first,
and then the conduct surrounding that, which is that she lied to the parents.
Well, actually, she didn't. But first, to go back, there was under Gerstein and McLaughlin, the government has a 48-hour period in which, after probable cause exists, after a warrantless arrest or here a warrantless seizure. With probable cause, the government has 48 hours to investigate and then have another hearing or release the person.
And I have a first hearing.
Yes, correct. Correct. Right. You don't need, and Jensen says, you don't need a probable cause, you don't need a pre-deprivation hearing if you have a hearing or release, certainly.
But the agents had already been told that the state's attorney was not going to seek a judicial order, give the child back.
But the state's attorney also testified that these decisions are evolving. Who knows what an investigation will show up? These are dynamic situations.
Hours, it expires, even at your best case scenario.
I'm sorry?
It expires.
Correct.
After 48 hours.
Correct. And the safety plan, everybody agrees, the safety plan was offered hours before it expired. Now, remember, under Terry and Dupuy both, the question is, what would a reasonable person think? This is, again, an objective standard. What would a reasonable person think confronted with the facts that the parents here knew? Okay, what did they know? They were told twice that temporary custody lasts 48 hours. They were told that when the child was removed, and they were told that the second day when the mom said, can I bring him home if you're not having the hearing? And she said, no, the 48 hours isn't up yet. So then, so on the moment that they were offered the safety plan, they knew 48 hours is as long as we can, as temporary custody lasts, and there's not going to be a petition. So the reasonable person would do what Dupuy said. They would thumb their nose at this
That's
offer.
Only if they've still got custody of the child.
No, it's not.
That's
they
the
would
you'd thumb your nose at somebody who's got your child and won't give it back?
Because
they tells you that you have no parental rights and you can't see him unless you sign this plan.
Which is true, because it's within the 48 hours that they
can't see the child unless they sign the plan.
At that moment. And in fact, I would like to read this from the record, because what happened here, this is a very important thing. There are two instances. One is at 87-4 at page 26, which is what page 195 of the deposition of Ms. Hernandez. Did you ask her any questions about the safety plan? No. I heard her say, I can go see my kids, so I really didn't care. That was it. She didn't care about the safety plan or the terms. What she wanted to do was see her child at that moment.
And would have signed anything, right?
And she would have signed anything. That's true.
Is that the position you want to take regarding the constitutional law
what
here?
The position I want to take is that a reasonable person would say, wait a second. You told me that this was going to be 48 hours. You told me you weren't going to file a petition. So what you're telling me is that I can have my child at the end of the day. Isn't that right? That's what Dupuy requires. That's what Terry requires.
So she's supposed to trust the state officials who are keeping her child in custody without having any probable cause at this point.
No, they still
simply
do
because
have...
they can, because the 48-hour clock has not run out.
I'm sorry, they still do have probable cause, because the only two things that are different is now there's conflicting medical evidence, which is, you know, there were the doctors, the skeletal exam doctors, and the other doctor, the doctor who put the cast on, who believed, unlike the original doctor and nurse, who thought that it wasn't abuse. But again, one of the doctors said, you know, when it's inconsistent, that's always a red flag. So again, inconsistent stories were red flags, and we don't know what these other two doctors knew. All we know is that they saw the child. We don't know if they had any of the backstory. In addition, the other fact is that the emergency room doctor had told Foster Stiff that this was a buccal fracture, but again, there is no evidence in the record that Foster Stiff appreciated the significance of this, that it isn't a twisting sort of thing, which is the normal abuse, but again,
there's a medical expert who's already said that, even before this point in time, that this fracture is not consistent with abuse.
Right, but again, that's still just conflicting medical evidence. It's not the initial doctor thought it was abuse. The second doctor thought it wasn't, and this is why the investigator did the right thing and sought a tie-breaking opinion about this. And we still, that tie-breaking opinion was not present yet. And you know, when the 48 hours was up. And now, again, with regard to the you have no parental rights, this was said with regard to the conditions of the safety plan, not prior to the safety plan. And, in fact, to be told this was an additional disincentive to sign the safety plan. But this is Ms. Hernandez at 420 in the supplemental appendix. She said that this was the safety plan and that once we sign it, we can go see James. But we couldn't be alone with him or take him anywhere. But we can go stay at my Grammy's house if we wanted to. Can't be unsupervised. My Grammy still has the custody over him, and that I don't have, like, my parental rights. So she was explaining the terms of the safety plan, which, again, would have made it a disincentive to sign the safety plan, because she was told that when the 48 hours was up, there was going to be no hearing. So she was going to get her child back.
This sounds like the kind of argument that one hears in fraud cases, that there were enough red flags that the victim should have known not to enter into this investment.
No, Your Honor. This is what Dupuy and Terry both say, that reasonable parents ask questions. And certainly, if nothing else, under Dupuy and Terry, that Ms. Foster, and Ms. Foster is the only defendant on the coercion claim.
We continue to ignore the material difference between this case and Dupuy, which is that in that case, the parents still had custody of the child. And in this case, they did not. And your caseworker represented to them that if they didn't sign this safety plan, they couldn't see the child.
At that moment, which was true, because
she in no way limited it to at that moment.
So again, under Dupuy and Terry, reasonable parents question the authority of the, and particularly in this case, in fact, the Hernandezes were in better position than pre-removal parents, because they already knew that temporary custody would last 48 hours, and they already knew that there would be no hearing. Before a child is removed, no, parents don't know that. Here the parents had a lot more information than parents usually have.
It sounds like you want the constitutional analysis here to depend upon parents mistrusting what DCFS staff tell them.
Your Honor, what the constitutional standard is that reasonable parents question authority. But if I may conclude with a quote from Tenenbaum, which is one of the phrases here. Protective service caseworkers must choose between difficult alternatives. If they err in interrupting parental custody, they may be accused of infringing the parent's constitutional rights. If they err in not removing the child, they risk injury to the child and may be accused of infringing the child's rights. It is precisely the function of qualified immunity to protect state officials in choosing between such alternatives, provided that there is an objectively reasonable basis for their decision. We ask that you affirm the district court's decision. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Bassett.
I have a question. It might take him a little longer.
Sure.
Is Lakeisha Foster the only defendant in the coercion claim?
No.
All three are?
Yes. In the coercion claim? Yeah.
Right.
Correct. Very, very, very briefly. First of all, the district court never referenced any lies. That was never brought before there's nothing in the record indicating that they thought there was a lie. In any event, that's a credibility determination that you can't make on summary judgment. Second, this notion that the state had a 48-hour magic period to do whatever they wanted doesn't make any sense. It's nonsensical. It completely trashes the concept of probable cause. You know, what if they had learned that the doctor, for some reason, had a vendetta against the Hernandezes? Under their theory, they could hold them for 48 hours and do whatever they want. Finally, the safety plan, if there's not evidence of coercion here, it's really is a blank check for safety plans under any circumstances. So thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.